Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I am Carolyn Witkus, registration number 39237. I am assisted by my associate, Heather Broxterman, registration 42895. I represent the appellant, Mr. DeLeon, who has come to observe today. I also represented Mr. DeLeon in the underlying district court action. For the ease of keeping the parties straight for my arguments, and remain consistent with the designation of the parties in the underlying action, as well as in my briefs, I will refer to the parties as father and mother. No disrespect is intended to anybody, obviously. So a finding of contempt of court is serious. It's very serious. And it's something that, as this court may have heard many, many times, comes up again and again and again in these domestic cases that go on for a fairly significant period of time sometimes on a post-decree basis. And father frankly feels that the trial court erred as a matter of law because there was insufficient evidence, in fact, there was no evidence, to support a finding of contempt in this case. There were three issues raised in our opening brief, whether there was certain rebuttal evidence admitted incorrectly over objection, whether there was an error in the finding of contempt, and whether Judge Stern should have recused himself as the underlying trial court judge. I think the most important issue before the court today is whether there was an appropriate finding of contempt in this case, and I'm going to spend the vast majority, if not all of my time, on that. And I apologize for any regurgitation of the facts I'm going to do. I'm sure you all have read the briefs, but the facts are important in this case. We had two hearings. This ended up being split over a couple of days, end of 2011, beginning of 2012. And the issues were surrounding whether father had correctly complied with the court's orders with regard to transition times on Sundays and certain holidays in the prior year or two. The critical holidays were Christmas / winter break, Easter and spring break, 4th of July, and then these Sunday transitions. And the real problem in this underlying case always was that the court orders just weren't clear. Now, if we don't have a clear and unambiguous court order, I think the law says you can't be in contempt. How can you hold a party in contempt if they don't know what they're supposed to do? Even Judge Stern acknowledged in his order that the times for transitions set forth in the myriad court orders in this case weren't clear. Was it 4? Was it 5? There was a parenting coordinator decision maker order that had stood, that had been, you know, upheld, that said it was one time. There were provisions in the parenting plan that said it was another time. There were provisions in the holiday times that said, well, we transition on the 4th of July in the morning. What does that mean? Does that mean 9 o'clock? Does that mean 11:30? Does that mean 1 minute to noon? And then there's a subsequent parenting coordinator or decision maker order that says all non-school transitions occur at an afternoon time. Which controls?
Well, let me just clarify, and I didn't mean to say you don't talk about any facts.
No, of course.
There is a provision in the orders, was there not, that says holiday parenting time supersedes regular parenting time?
There was a provision in the parenting plan that said that.
Okay. So let me ask you about, and I recognize there are different issues on these, and I think they are different. I think the argument about Christmas is different than Easter and the 4th of July, for example.
Certainly.
Let me ask you about the 4th of July one. It does say that you have to return the child, if parent has the child, on the morning of the day after, or some language like that.
Correct.
Why? Now, I understand that where the court was talking about ambiguity was kind of the, I forget the exact language, was non-holiday time or something. There's those
right.
Other ambiguity. Why on that one doesn't the specific provision control? I mean, what's unclear about the morning of the 5th of July? Why do you bring in the kind of non-holiday times, or was it Sunday, or I can't remember what this provision was.
No, I understand, Your Honor, and it's a good point. So the parenting plan that says the morning of the 4th of July was entered, I believe, in 2008, after a full hearing. Subsequent to that, the parties had agreed to the appointment of a PCDM, and I can tell the court the transitions are probably always going to be a problem in this case. And one or both parties went to the PCDM and said, we have a problem doing transitions that do not occur at school. Any transition that does not occur at school is a problem. Responding to that problem, Sue Waters issued an order that says all non-school transitions will occur at this specific time. holiday, non-holiday, summer, vacation. I would argue that the subsequent PCDM decision that became an order of court would control for all non-school parenting time. Is that subject to interpretation? Absolutely. We just had a conversation. I actually answered a question about it. Of course it's subject to interpretation. Is a party in contempt because their interpretation differs from the other party's interpretation when it's unclear? I would argue not. They don't, for lack of a better phrase, know what the court order is, which is a required element of contempt. We have a similar issue with the spring break Easter. You know, one parent gets spring break, one parent gets Easter. Often the two overlap, and in a perfect world, that would have been more artfully drafted to deal with that. What do you do when they overlap? That was the question. Does father's parenting time, if he has spring break, take precedence over mother's parenting time if she has Easter? Does mother's parenting time if she has Easter take precedence over father's parenting time if he has spring break?
Mr. Wickes, let me just ask a question about that, because you're saying that we may have conflicting orders here, but what we do have is an order clearly saying a holiday supersedes regular parenting time.
Correct.
And then we're also discussing school time and non-school time.
Right.
So my question for you is whether it's school transitions or non-school transitions. Would you agree that's both non-holiday?
Spring break, and if you're asking about whether spring break is a school transition or a non-school transition, mm-hmm. spring break was designated in the parenting plan in the holiday section.
Okay, so it's your position that holiday includes winter break and spring break?
That's correct.
Okay, so the interpretation is it's not just Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, 4th of
correct.
July?
Correct.
All right.
And they are designated in the party's parenting plan in this case as holiday parenting time. So spring break would supersede either party's ability to take a week of their vacation time during that week, if that makes sense, because holiday parenting time supersedes vacation parenting time. Spring break is allocated to a parent in a particular way that is distinct from the normal parenting, regular parenting time schedule.
Okay, so the next question is non-school versus school transition. Do either of those fall into winter break, spring break, or what is non-school versus school transition?
And I think that these questions get to the heart of why there isn't a contempt in this case. Sometimes in the multiple parenting time orders in this case, there is a specific time for a transition for a holiday takes place at school. So for example, a break time may run from the end of school until the children return to school, and then it's a school time transition. Sometimes there's no designation of when the transitions take place. Sometimes we have a default provision that was created by the PCDM. It's really unclear. And even Judge Stern noted that. He notes that right in his orders. It's right in the transcript. There's a bunch of confusion about when these transitions are supposed to occur. It is confusing. I can tell this court that I've been working on this case since 2007, and it still is a challenge to figure out exactly what we do every time we have a holiday fight to this day. It's incredibly confusing. And what happens, and the court has read the briefs, what happened is that father interpreted it one way and mother interpreted it another way. And there is no clearer example of this than in the winter break Christmas context. So what the court order says is that one parent gets Christmas Eve and one parent gets Christmas Day, and it's the transition on Christmas Day occurs on the 26th. The parent that has Christmas Day also gets the second half of winter break. The parent that gets Christmas Eve also gets the first half of winter break. If that results in a non-mathematically equal division, there needs to be some day shifting. Order says in the middle of the break. It also says that if dad has the second half, if father has the second half of Christmas break, he is entitled to travel with the children because his family lives in California. You have to read the court order so that they all make sense. Now, if mother's interpretation were correct and the day splitting that has to occur in the middle of the winter break had to be the evening of the 26th, the provision that allows father to travel if he has Christmas Day would be rendered meaningless every year. How does he travel when he has one day, Christmas Day, and then come back and transition on the 26th and then pick the kids up on the 27th? That doesn't work. That provision would be rendered meaningless. And what does in the middle mean? Here we go again. What does the morning mean? What does in the middle mean? It doesn't mean the 26th. It could mean the 28th. It could mean the 30th. It could mean the 27th. Mother wanted the 26th. Father wanted the end of the break so he could travel. There was a dispute as to what that meant, and it was unclear. There's no contempt when there's not a clear court order. I think that I've addressed the issue with the Sunday night transitions at the beginning by discussing the PCDM orders and the prior court orders. It's unclear.
Well, let me ask about that one. I think, and correct me, the record I think was pretty clear, I think, that in all cases it was after 5. I mean, it could be noon, it could be 4, it could be 5, but it seemed like there were a lot of instances where it was after 5 and Father didn't dispute that. Am I wrong about that?
I believe the testimony was there was one instance that was a mistake that occurred after 5 because there was some issue with not hearing the phone and not knowing where Mom was, and he apologized for it, and there was some dispute about that one instance. Mother testified that there were a lot of instances. Father testified candidly that there was one problem and this is what had happened, and he was sorry and it was an accident. That was more of a disputed issue. There was really no dispute about what these court orders said, and that Mother got actually more of the winter break in that particular year. There was no dispute that she did not get the parenting time over Easter, but that it was conflicting with spring break. There was no dispute that there was a transition on the 4th of July and that it was at PCDM time versus the morning or noon, which is what Mother wanted.
Well, Ms. Witkus, if there is a dispute of fact and the trial court makes a finding one's more credible than the other, we may be bound by that on appeal.
You very well may be. If it is a pure issue of fact, then yes, the Court of Appeals is bound by the trial court's findings of fact. I would argue that this is a mixed issue of fact and law that we've got before us, and the Court of Appeals can take multiple approaches. You can try to parse out which part is the fact and which part is the law and apply those standards. You can decide that on the whole, this is more of a legal issue and apply the de novo standard. You can decide on the whole this is more of a factual issue and apply the abuse of discretion standard to the entire thing. That comes from Valdez v. People, 966 P2D 587 from the Colorado Supreme Court in 1998. I don't know that it's helpful for this court to hear about the rebuttal exhibits or the recusal of Judge Stern, in particular because he's been rotated off that particular docket and this case is no longer in front of him, and it's not a huge issue anymore. It was. It's not so much anymore, and I'm going to reserve my last 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you, Ms. Witkus.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dale Parrish. My registry number is 11260. I represent Dr. Jimenez, and I would like to address the arguments made by Mr. De Leon's counsel. First, I did not represent Dr. Jimenez in the lower court at this time.
Excuse me, counsel. Has there been, you said your name is Mr. Cush?
No,
Parrish.
Dale.
Oh, I'm Parrish. Sorry. I misheard.
I'll try to speak more clearly, Your Honor. Okay. The first issue that Ms. Witkus addressed has to do with the contempt finding. So I'll take that up. I would like to make mention the rebuttal exhibits briefly at the end of my argument. The contempt finding was based upon several facts, and I don't believe that the court's findings or its rulings are mixed issues of fact and law. I believe these are factual findings. And specifically, with respect to contempt, the court found that there was language in the applicable order that required division of Christmas between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, and the court clearly defined which was which. Noon on December 24 to noon on December 25 was defined as Christmas Eve. Noon on December 25 to noon on December 26 was defined as Christmas Day. At page 14 of the appellant's opening brief, it's argued that both parties testified mother had the kids until December 24, noon, and then again, January 3. There's no question that father did not allow mother to have the children either on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And there's no injection of confusion. There's no argument about different interpretations that can cloud the issue. The court clearly defined both. So again, on page 14, appellants argue that mother had the children until noon on December 24. They change that position in their reply brief at page 6, where they argue that mother had the kids until noon on December 25 now. That argument just doesn't hold water. The fact is that Judge Stern's finding of contempt is solid, and it's based upon the facts that were adduced at the hearing. And
I'm sorry, Mr. Parrish, I need to interrupt you because I want to make sure I don't lose you on the facts.
Nope.
What you've said has surprised me, because I always understood the court's order as saying there was contempt on this Christmas because father didn't return the child on December 26th at noon. I'm not seeing, and if I missed it, I apologize, but I'm asking for your help, where the court found a contempt because father had the child on Christmas Eve as well. I thought the contempt finding was only because dad didn't return the child by noon on the 26th. Am I wrong?
No, you are not. The court found that there was a transfer time on December 26th at noon and that father failed to abide
right, okay.
by that transfer time.
Okay.
What I'm pointing out is that factually, mother has, or a father has argued that both parties testified that father picked up the kids on December 24 at noon. And so in terms of looking at the clear language of the court order and whether or not the court had a clear order to enforce and find that there was obedience or disobedience to, there's no question about noon on the 24th to noon on the 25th or noon on the 25th to noon on the 26th. There's no question about it. Similarly, you asked a question about the morning after July 4th.
Before you go into that, because I do want to hear what you have to say, but I'd like you to respond to Ms. Witkus's argument on Christmas, because that one does strike me as different as the 4th of July, where it does say dad can get the child the second half of the Christmas break. Dad could travel out of state. I mean, so doesn't that, I recognize you would say it's clear to you, 26 means the 26th at noon, and your client, I'm sure, would say that too. But is there not some ambiguity when it says father gets the second half of that break and can travel out of state? Why do you return the child at noon if you can do that? And what does middle mean?
It's true that the court never defined the middle when referring to day shifting. And there is a provision that says if father has the second half of Christmas or Christmas Day, noon the 25th or the 26th, that if he also has the second half of the break, he may combine those. I hope I've answered your question.
Yeah, but doesn't, so my question then, I guess maybe the second question, is doesn't that create some ambiguity at least on that provision? You know, where father can say, I thought I got the second half of the month. I can travel. How is that contempt if that's at least that provision is ambiguous?
My answer is yes, I think that it does.
And
on that isolated provision.
Okay. Yes, that there is some ambiguity.
Correct.
All right. I appreciate your candor on that. I interrupted you as you were about to go on to the 4th of July.
Well, I was going to use another example. The order is clear that it says the morning of July 5. Now, counsel has tried to inject some ambiguity or create some confusion, but there can be no confusion that returning the child at 5 p.m. on July 5 is not in accordance with the court order. Two questions from this panel were, doesn't holiday time trump? Absolutely. And that means that holiday order about July 5 in the morning was disobeyed as found by Judge Stern, because the child was returned at 5 p.m. that night, period. You asked, Your Honor, what is the non-school versus school? What does that mean? How does that stack up? And I think the answer to your question is clear. Non-school versus school transitions means exchanges for parenting time purposes that take place away from these twins, the girls' school. It doesn't delineate holiday versus regular parenting time. It means it's an exchange that takes place at a location other than the school. Simple as can be. That does not change or inject any uncertainty into holiday parenting time provision that says July 5 in the morning. So another question that you asked or observation that you made that I would like to expand on is, in many of these instances, what we're seeing is Judge Stern's decision about who was telling the truth and who wasn't at the two different hearings. That's what it boils down to. There's one other example, and I think that you touched upon it, Judge Gabriel, when you asked about the times after 5 p.m. The record is clear that one of those return times was 6:15 p.m. And there is no ambiguity that the return time was supposed to be Sundays at 5 p.m. Again, regardless of how that was missed or why that was missed, we're looking at Judge Stern's, at the time, decision about who's being more truthful here, who's more credible. And 6:15 is not 5 p.m. And he found that to be contempt.
Let me ask a question I asked your opposing counsel. What is winter break and what is spring break? Is that a holiday or is that regular parenting time?
Holiday.
Okay.
And counsel was correct. It is delineated in the parenting plan. Now, I would like to say a word about the rebuttal exhibits. Actually, a couple of words. First, there has been no argument offered here regarding the law cited by the appellant under Rule 37 that these exhibits should be excluded unless harmless. It's in their brief. And I believe unless harmless should be warrants your attention, because I believe that these exhibits were emails between the parties. So whether or not these are rebuttal exhibits means that if the father's emails to mother contradict his contempt defenses, they are rebuttal. There's no surprise to a litigant who has some of his or her own written communications pulled out as rebuttal exhibits, and especially when, in the case, rebuttal exhibits were endorsed beforehand. There's no question that there wasn't disclosure under the 7-day rule under 16.2. What I'm arguing is that this was harmless. Judge Stern was looking at this saying, what prejudice could there be to you, Mr. De Leon? These are your communications at the time. And specifically, if these are communications that claims he didn't understand the time versus if he's acknowledging the time of return of the children in one of these emails. So I believe it was harmless inclusion. I believe there was no surprise. And when the appellant argues that he was unjustly forced to defend against this evidence at the last minute, he's saying that he was required to defend his own statements that he authored at the time of the contemptuous behavior. In addition, the appellant has argued in their brief at page 3 in the reply, that mother appears to argue that every possible argument against an exhibit should have been made at trial at the time it is offered. Almost. And that is the law of this jurisdiction. And that is that you must specify your objection to the exhibit at the time you make your objection. And what we're talking about here is the fact that appellant did not claim at the time he made his objections that the evidence didn't qualify as rebuttal evidence. In fact, appellant didn't make that argument in the Rule 59 motion that was filed either, and it appears for the first time in the briefings to this court. The fact is that it does qualify as rebuttal evidence, and that finding would be in your record had appellant made that argument or specified his objection at the time. Finally, a word about the bias. The case that was cited in the brief is the Boehmer case at 767 Pacific 2nd, 787. Essentially, appellant argues that because the court expressed an opinion about Mr. De Leon and ruled against Mr. De Leon, that that demonstrates disqualifiable bias or prejudice. Boehmer says that neither expressed opinions or rulings are sufficient to show disqualifying bias. In fact, the cases even show that wrong rulings do not demonstrate prejudice or disqualifying bias. And appellant is quick to point out that there is a wrong ruling with respect to the attorney fee award. And there was one other ruling that has been reversed subsequently, and that has to do with prohibiting father from filing motions without meeting a certain standard. These do not demonstrate a disqualifying bias on the part of Judge Stern. They do highlight how Judge Stern felt about the testimony of the parties and the credibility of the parties and who had what amount of integrity. But it doesn't show that he should be recused because he demonstrated this prejudice from anything other than the evidence that was offered during the hearing. And I agree with counsel that he was reassigned before the 63 days ran with respect to the Rule 59 motion. I don't believe that there was grounds for recusal even if he had not been reassigned. And I don't believe that a new trial should be granted or that the contempt findings overturned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parrish. Ms. Witkus, you have 2 minutes and 7 seconds.
I'll try to talk back. Briefly, with regard to the rebuttal emails, Your Honors, it was just represented to the court that those would have, of course, been rebuttals because they were responding to Mr. De Leon, to father's defenses to the contempts against him. In fact, the emails were presented as a defense to Mr. De Leon's counter-contempt against Dr. Jimenez, and that was what was represented to the court when I made my objection. It's on page 96 of the transcript. The reason it was such a big deal, these are emails between the parties, there's a lot of emails. And as the court can see from pages 107 through 109 of the transcript, there were some issues about the veracity or authenticity of emails in this case. So to go through that many emails and try to address those kinds of issues was impossible. But I want to come back to what really is at the heart of this. The purpose of remedial contempt is to persuade a party to comply with court orders. The purpose of punitive contempt is to punish conduct offensive to the dignity of the court. Setting aside that there was no more compliance to enforce as these events had passed and father can't go back in time, what we're talking about is confusion. Confusion about transition times, confusion about overlapping holidays, confusions about what the middle means or what the morning means or whether the April 14th, 2008 court order for all non-school transitions to occur at 4 p.m. supersedes the December 2007 court order that says transitions occur in the morning. Does that rise to conduct offensive to the dignity of the court? This is important to Mr. De Leon or we wouldn't be standing here. He lost most of his holiday parenting time for the following holidays as a sanction for this contempt. That was the sanction. There was no jail time, there was no fine. There were attorney's fees that the party stipulated could not have been ordered. That was the sanction. He lost his parenting time over holiday days with his children because of confusion about whether he should have had the night of the 26th of December or returned the children 5 hours later on the 4th of July. And really, there wasn't sufficient evidence for those kinds of findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Witkus. And thank you again, Mr. Parrish. We appreciate the briefs and arguments of both counsel. And the case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes our 2:30 docket and our docket for the day. So the court will be in recess and the bailiff may so announce.